Okay, hello? Oh, that's there. That was cool. So, just want to make sure that, yes, it is recording. Good. Hello? Second time I see you all in lecture. Just so you know, I am recording this lecture again. I have not put the other ones up online. Going away last week, of course. I am a bit discombobulated still from flying out to Banff and coming back, but it was a good trip. Good for research, and now I will be here for the rest of the term, which is good. So, first off, I had some questions on the assignment. My basic policy is to give you all 2 weeks for an assignment. The assignment has not come out yet, so the assignment cannot be due next Thursday. So you'll have a bit more time. My plan is to get it out by this Thursday, and then you'll have 2 weeks after that, and I'll adjust the other dates accordingly. What was I thinking? So other quick question before I get going? Yes?
You said you will not be uploading any talk, any notes at all?
So I will be, so I'll be adding some stuff to the wiki about like kind of topics and stuff. I don't tend to put lots of notes on the wiki. Well, it depends on the topic. Sometimes I'll upload material and things, but I'm not. Mostly my lectures tend to be more oral, and so that's why I put the recordings online. But the idea is that the lectures cover material that's covered in your texts. So for example, today I'm mainly going to be talking from JavaScript, the good parts, talking about things, but not repeating what's in there, but more talking about the material from a different perspective. Because what's the point of repeating what's already there besides... I feel like if you try to see material from different perspectives, you understand it better. So you all have the texts, right? There's two required texts, JavaScript, the good parts, and learning Node.
And will we be tested on code-based questions, or will they be more theory-based?
On the assignments? Or on the tests?
The tests, yeah.
Both. Because... what's the point of theory without being able to actually do something? So my tests tend to be oriented around not so much writing a lot of code, but more reading code. And so the assignments will have some writing of code, but also a good bit of reading code. Because, well, it turns out in the real world, you're going to be mostly reading code rather than writing code, because you'll be working on larger projects. So if you can't figure out what other people's code is doing, you're going to have problems. So there'll be a lot of, so you'll have to read code and figure things out from there. Does that help? You have a puzzled expression on your face.
What?
Yeah.
No, I was wondering if we should be the ones uploading, like,
yes, notes. And in fact, actually, that is why I say on the wiki that you may get an account. It is not required, but I am happy to give you all accounts on my wiki if you do not already have one. If you have a data class, and then you can add stuff to it. But, so, yes. Uploading notes to the wiki is appreciated, and I will try to edit them, but I've noticed I tend to get busy during the term, so I think it works better as a way of collaborating amongst you all, and if there's specific questions on there that you're not sure about, then you ask me. So here's a list of topics I want to start talking about here. And then the last thing is objects. I suspect we're going to spend more than today talking about objects. Right now, today, I want to give more in-depth context. So last time, we talked about the overall architecture of the web application, talked about having a server, client, which is the web browser, and a back-end database. So for the first half of this class, we're basically not going to talk about back-end databases. We're going to pretend that databases don't exist for the moment, and we're also going to, for the most part, pretend that client-side JavaScript, at least in a modern sense, doesn't exist. We're going to use a bit of jQuery and stuff, but we're not going to do the full dynamic client stuff. What we're going to focus on instead is on the server, on JavaScript running there, getting comfortable with that, and generating pages for clients. after the midterm, we'll switch gears and we'll start talking about databases on the back end, and we'll start talking about client-side JavaScript. So this is a term, have you all heard of AJAX? How many of you have heard the term AJAX? So AJAX stands for Asynchronous JavaScript and XML. The funny thing is nowadays, it's really just Asynchronous JavaScript. The XML's kind of gone away. Although it's still there in a bit. But the idea is that classic JavaScript only ran in response to user events. It would never run in the background. And modern JavaScript will run continuously in the background. That's how your email client can access mail in the background, can go ahead and grab new mail as it comes up, and it doesn't refresh the entire page. So you'll learn how that works and how that fits into it. That will be the second half of the class. Now we're concentrating on simple client stuff and server infrastructure, in particular JavaScript running on the server. So we'll be talking a lot about JavaScript, and then we'll also be talking about Node and how that all fits together. So before you look at JavaScript at all, you have to understand a bit about the context of JavaScript, how it was created. So first off, does JavaScript have anything to do with Java? The only reason JavaScript is called JavaScript is because Netscape already had Java applets incorporated into their browser, and they needed a language for scripting web pages, to make web pages more dynamic, where they weren't using embedded Java applets. So they talked with Sun and got permission to call it JavaScript, but completely different language. The only reason why they at all look similar, if you're looking at the text, is because both JavaScript and Java have syntax inspired by C. They are both C-like languages. But that's it. Otherwise, their programming model is completely different. So, all of you have learned Java at this point, right? You ever come with Java, you've all had a C course, right? Because still requirement here is that you've had 2401. What other languages do you know? So C++ some, okay. For our purposes, same old, same old. Yes?
Racket.
I don't actually know Racket. Lisp? Who knows Lisp? What is it for? What? Oh, and what class did you learn that on your own? Oh, you've had 3007.
Yeah, that's what he's talking about.
Okay, so Racket's it's a scheme variant?
Racket's the IDE, I believe.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So Racket's the IDE. It's for scheme, right? Okay, so scheme, if you've had scheme, the stuff should actually, if you've had, how many of you have had 3007 in a year? Okay, for those of you, this early part will actually be pretty straightforward, because basically JavaScript is scheme in C syntax plus object notation. That's all it is. And a few mess ups in the syntax. But that's basically what JavaScript is. And that's why JavaScript is very much not Java or C. It's taught in a programming paradigms class. And actually, part of the curriculum redesign of which this course is a part of is to take ideas from 3007 and shove them into second year. Because actually, they're important there. So, because like you might notice you might go at scheme, what scheme or something? It's like, how is that important? It's like, yes, scheme is implemented in some places, but JavaScript is everywhere. You use it every day, literally. So history of JavaScript. So JavaScript has nothing to do with Java. It was created over the course of a couple of weeks. I've heard like 10 days or something. Was how long Brendan Each, I can't pronounce his name, but the creator of JavaScript, he basically was told at Netscape saying, we need a programming language for scripting web pages. Go. And he went off and created this language. And then it got into Netscape Navigator 2 in the late 90s, and then spread around the world from there. So JavaScript is everywhere, not because it's a great language, it's because it got there at the right time, and it becomes standardized. And unfortunately, it became prematurely standardized, because it's the first draft of a language. It's a first draft of a language. It's not actually a refined, polished language. There are ongoing standardization work. There's ongoing efforts to improve the language, but it's a rough draft. And what that means is mistakes were made, and we have to live with those mistakes. But the good news is some amazing ideas got incorporated into JavaScript, ideas that are so good that let you get around most of the glitches. So that's one reason why I love talking about JavaScript. So to really understand JavaScript, you shouldn't think about C. You shouldn't think about Java. You think about Lisp. So Lisp is an old language. It is considered to be the second oldest language in regular use nowadays, the oldest language being Fortran, i.e. it goes back to the late 1950s. So in programming language terms, you go like, wow. And it is a very old language. Modern variants of it have names like Scheme. Scheme is definitely Lisp. It's basically a cleaner version of it. The reason why it's important to think about Lisp in the context of JavaScript is because Lisp was developed, Lisp stands for List Processing. And this List Processing was in the context of artificial intelligence research. And in the 50s and 60s, artificial intelligence research was all about symbolic programming. So you wanted to have symbols to represent concepts, and an intelligent computer would process those symbols in some way. And so Lisp makes it very easy to represent and manipulate symbols. And so while all of Lisp's capabilities aren't there exactly in JavaScript, its underlying programming model very much is. So when I say model, we're talking about a couple of things. One is we're talking about the read, eval, print. Read, eval, print loop. If you're used to compiled languages, a read, eval, print loop is really, really strange. If you've ever used interpreted languages, it's completely natural. The key element of a read, eval, print loop, of course, is eval. Eval is a function that takes some sort of textual input, evaluates it, and then returns a result. So in a read, eval, print loop, you basically are just running eval all the time. But you have another function called read, which takes input, parses it, sends it to the eval function, and then when whatever comes out of it, it outputs it as print. Now, in a classic Lisp interpreter, the output of print can almost always be sent to read. So this, if you think about this for a second, it should seem a little strange. This means that the output is done in a format that can be always parsed by the read input routines. So this means that when you output a data structure from the print, that data structure is in a format that can be read in, and you recreate the data structure. Do your programs normally have this property? Not really. Like, if you have this nice tree inside of your program, How do you get it into your program? Well, you have to write some custom parsing routine to take whatever it is and figure out what the spaces are and build up your tree. And then when you print out that tree, you have to write a routine to specially print it. And that routine will be different than the one that read it in the first place. In the language like Lisp, those were unified. And that's why they had these, that's why Lisp has this really bad reputation with, oh my god, it's full of parentheses. And it is full of parentheses. But when I say the parentheses, they're all representing lists. And so you can have things like, you know, I want to have a this is a kind of a data structure represented in Lisp. So you say that this is A, and this refers to, so if we turn the head, so the car is A, and this points to B. Forget it, I will not show you the data structure because this is not needed. Anyway, I could teach you Lisp, it would actually be a lot of fun, but instead I should teach you JSON. How many of you have heard of JSON? Okay, more, good. JavaScript does not have that exact property of this, of what you print out can be set read in directly, but this notion that your program's output should potentially be in a format that's easily read into the program is very much in there in JavaScript. And that is something known as JavaScript Object Notation, or JSON. So JSON is a subset of JavaScript that allows you to output data structures. So when your Gmail or whatever application now is communicating with other servers and it wants to download data, it doesn't download the data in a format that'll have to do a lot of elaborate parsing. It downloads the data in text, typically in a JSON structure, which means that it's actually in a subset of JavaScript. That's the data interchange format, is a language subset. So, anyway. When you're making a language, so the first, Lisp was originally an experimental language. It was never designed to be implemented. But then someone, one of John McCarthy's students, I think, looked at the language and said, hey, I can implement a vowel. And they hand-coded this part of it. And once they had that, then these two parts were really easy to make. And then they had a full Lisp environment running when they didn't intend for one to be there. JavaScript, so what is the eval equivalent in a language like C? Is there an eval, which means that let's take a statement that is in C, and I want to convert it into code and run it. There's no run statement in C.
Compile and run. Oh, you mean like an actual code statement?
Yeah, like so. If you have a fragment of C, and I want to find out what does that little bit of code do? What do? You put it in a text file. You run the compiler. You run the linker. You execute it, and then you see what happens. With a read eval print loop, you don't do that. You just type in the expression. Now, in your environment, when you run Node, Node it has built into it a read eval print loop. So that means you type in Node without any arguments. It gives you a prompt. Basically, it's like a shell, except that it doesn't understand Bash. It doesn't run commands. It takes JavaScript code. And you can type in any valid JavaScript code that Node will understand. And it will evaluate it right there and give you a value back. If you tell it to print something, it does it. So you have a function, you're going, is this syntactically correct? Will this do anything interesting? You can just type in the code right there and then check to see what was created. So you can see this as a programming environment. It's very powerful because you can do things incrementally, iteratively. You don't have to sit there and say, oh, I wrote this program, but I didn't add any code to find out what the value of X is. Well, I better add a print statement to it and use X. Or I better get out a debugger and then attach it to the running process and make sure the process doesn't die and then walk through it with GDB or some other debugger. No. You just run it in your environment and then say, oh, what's X? And it knows what X is because it's all inside the environment. So that's one good thing you'll find about playing with JavaScript, particularly in the context of something like Node, is that you don't have this whole compilation step. But you should also realize this is also potentially a downside. Where is the equivalent of a compile time error? There are no compile time errors. There are only runtime errors. To a first approximation. I mean, there's all the errors when you give it some code to evaluate or something, but this will interpret what you give it and will potentially give an error or not. And also, in order to support this kind of structure, JavaScript and other languages that support read-eval print loops are typically not statically typed. They are what are known as loosely typed. Or you could say weakly typed if you're from the camp that thinks this is better. You know, but weak sounds kind of negative, and we don't want to be negative about this because, well, some of us love it, but it is loosely typed. Now, what does that mean? Well, that refers to what is the nature of the symbols you manipulate. So, if you're looking at some C code, and I say, x equals 5. What is that code doing? Yeah, it's storing the value 5 in memory somewhere, in the storage that's associated with X. But what is that? How is that data bit encoded in memory? There's some bit of information that is missing here.
It's type.
It's type. You don't know the type of X. I am not declared it. And that makes things fundamentally ambiguous in a language like C. What'd you say? But I don't know. We know what this is. So let's say X is an int. Could be a, or it could be a double. Could be a short. Could be a char. It could be a lot of different things, and depends, you know, if it's a floating point value, it'll be represented very differently in memory than if it's an integer. Similarly, you start trying to assign to, let's say, I want to say y equals x. Will that generate an error? Maybe, right? Because it depends what y and x are. Are they compatible types? Maybe I have to do some coercion. In a language like JavaScript, this is not ambiguous. And this is always correct. So, the compiler, the runtime environment can check if you try to do something that's nonsensical. Like, for example, if you say y equals x plus 5, and it turns out x is like some random object, not a number. So I go, and there's no operator overloading in JavaScript. So you might say, well, okay, I can't add something to this, so it will give an error. But it will not give you an error when you enter this code. Because this code could be corrupt. It will only give you the error when it is executed. Then I'll say, hey, you just tried adding, you know, a number to an object you can't add to. So, sorry. But if there's a compiler and I knew in advance that X was not a numeric type, or Y was not a numeric type, then I could say, that's wrong. So things that are classically compile time errors in a statically typed, it's more of a static language, they become runtime errors. You have to run the program and see it. So you can have errors sitting in your program that a compiler would have looked at and said, oh, that's no way. You won't see those errors unless that code is executed. You can have syntax-like errors in routines that never get run, and like only when the error condition is, oh, wow, that code is just wrong. That's one reason why some people really don't like loosely typed languages, because they can't catch certain classes of errors. Well, they can catch them, but they only catch them very late in the process. But the trade-off for that is that it lets you do things in a very flexible way. And first of all, it enables things like this. Now, as far as the other advantages of doing things dynamically, we will see. I can try telling you about it, but it's easier to be shown. I'll just say that typically in these sort of languages, you can write smaller programs that are more expressive, that are more general programs. You might say, well, aren't they slow? Because that's the other reason why people like static typing, is not only does it catch errors, it potentially allows the creation of much more efficient code, because it can specialize to the types. Whereas a slow language might need a more general form. Well, it is true in general that you can get faster code from a language simply because it does less. But in practice, the difference is much less than you'd think. And that's because there's lots of fancy ways of doing it. Normally, if you're willing to pay some of a memory overhead, you can get very close to similar runtimes. And for code, that's frankly generally a lot less buggy. So, you might have heard some people hate JavaScript. You all heard that. I know you heard that. JavaScript's a horrible language. You never want to learn it. Why do you want to take it seriously? We should throw it out in the dumpster and run away screaming. If you haven't heard that, some people are of the opinion that JavaScript is like that. I would not agree. But there is a reason for this hate. And that's not so much because of JavaScript. It's because of the browser. So when Netscape created the JavaScript, they wanted JavaScript to be able to dynamically manipulate a web page. They wanted it to be able to add content to the web page, remove it. They want to be able to make menus appear and disappear. They want to have dynamic control. And so they had to create an API for the web page. They had to give a programmatic way to talk about the data structure in the web page and to modify them. Anyone know what that API is called?
DOM.
Yep, the DOM. Which is short for the Document Object Model. JavaScript has its quirks. The DOM is ugly. Painful. And inconsistent. That's actually the worst, the worst thing about it is that different browsers don't implement the DOM in exactly the same way. It used to be a lot more variations in it. I mean, back when Internet Explorer 6 was, you know, much more common, Internet Explorer 6 did its DOM in a way completely different than everyone else. Internet Explorer 6 is, I think, mostly gone, and so now the DOM is more standardized. But mostly standardized does not mean perfect. There's still quirks. So you write your code to work on one web browser, and then you run another web browser, it potentially won't work quite right. And that has to do with how the DOM is implemented and how the browser in general conforms to web standards. Your HTML standards, cascading style sheets, and DOM access routines. That's where your pain is. It's much less than it used to be, but it's still a factor. So, especially now with mobile devices, there's been all these new routines that have been added to the DOM to access things like touch events. And that stuff is still being standardized. So in some ways, we've kind of gotten back to the problems of the Netscape days, in that we have proprietary extensions to the web browser to add new capabilities. And if you want to use those new capabilities, now you have to deal with, well, what browser am I on? So that is one key hell that is web programming. We're not going to talk about the DOM much right now, on purpose. In the second half of the course, we'll have to talk about the DOM a good bit. But the DOM is not JavaScript, and if it doesn't matter what language you are programming a web page in, you'd still have to deal with that ugliness. But don't blame JavaScript for this. Not its fault. And in fact, actually, I'd say JavaScript makes it relatively painless to deal with this. So I mentioned that JavaScript is a quirky language, and we will talk about some of these quirks later on, but I want to talk about some of the simple ones first, just to give you an idea of how rough drafty this is. So let's say you're defining a function in JavaScript. So, let's say F. I'm trying to remember my syntax now. This is one reason I do not ask you to regurgitate exact syntax, because I have trouble remembering the syntax as much as you all do. It's more important to read code than... Okay, so, what is the keyword?
No.
F, yeah, I think... Yeah, I'll use that. So, we'll just say... Anyway, I'm just trying to remember... I can't believe it. So we'll just say we have a function A, B. This isn't quite the right syntax, but... But the point of what I want to talk, so you have a function here, and let's say we refer to, say, we say x equals 7. So I say x equals 7 inside of a function. If this was a language like Java or C, normally if you see something like this and there's no specification of x anywhere here, you kind of go, that seems a bit problematic. Probably this will generate a compile time error. Because you don't, especially in a language like Java, you don't normally have random symbols in the middle of your function that are not defined in some sort of context. You're like if there's a function here and you expect to see that maybe the enclosed class would define x or something. But the compiler will probably keep you out of trouble. That is not the case in JavaScript. It's actually rather bad. If you assign to a variable that has not been otherwise scoped for this function, so like you don't say, let me say bar, I think is the keyword. Bar, you know, x equals 7. If you say this, then it's saying, okay, now you're getting a new variable. But if you just do an assignment, it becomes a global variable instantly. In other words, you make a mistake, it will actually not report it as a mistake. It will let you do this as much as you want. But in so doing, it will start creating global variables.
Repeat that last part again. How do you create a global variable?
Just assign to
just
it.
Just open.
Anywhere. And if you haven't actually specified it as a local variable, it will become a global variable. By default. Yes? So this is another part of yes. So if I say,
I'm just going to look up the syntax of the right answer.
Globals have this really funny role in JavaScript. It's that there is no linker in JavaScript, so all symbols can be seen globally by everyone else. So, in fact, one of the key restrictions you have in writing JavaScript code is to make sure you don't clobber anyone else's variables. You might go, wait, how do I do that? How do I make sure I don't cause problems? Well, it turns out there's the object notation is so clean in JavaScript, and the ways we're using it are so nice that, in general, you don't have to. It's not too bad. But you still have to worry about explicitly saying that this something is a variable the first time you use it. Because if you don't, it will just become a global variable. And that means that different routines that refer to the same thing will now all go to the global namespace and will potentially interfere with each other. You've all learned how global variables are evil, right? Yes, that's what they... And globals are a fundamental part of JavaScript. There keeps being proposals about adding namespaces and things to isolate symbols and stuff in JavaScript, and none of it has taken off yet. And even if they standardized on it tomorrow and say this is how it is, you still have to deal with the existing population of all the JavaScript interpreters. So, you have to worry about, don't pollute the global namespace. Now, there are JavaScript checkers and modes you can do JavaScript where it will say, oh, this is an error. You're accessing a variable that you have not specifically declared before as being a variable, and so we will not make that so we will not do anything with it. So one quirk, another funny quirk, is how comments are notated in JavaScript. There are two basic ways to do comments: slash star and double slash. Double slash for lines, this is for blocks. Don't use this. Anyone know why? What? It's not so much they can't be nested, it's that regular code can contain those symbols. Because you can use... forward slashes are also the symbol for regular expressions. And JavaScript has extensive support for regular expressions. And star is a valid regular expression character. So you can do things like start a comment, and if there's a regular expression in the code that you commented, it will actually end the comment in the middle of the regular expression. I mean, you'll probably notice this because your program will just act really strange when you do that, but yeah. Just use this, the double slashes. They could have picked some other two-character combination to do block comments that wasn't valid syntactically anywhere else in the language. Why is this there? It's because this is the standard comment characters in other languages like C, and they didn't notice that it conflicted with the other syntax of the language. This is what happens in a first draft. You make mistakes. And now you don't have time to fix them. So, one of the premises of the JavaScript, the Good Parts book, is that the best way to deal with errors like this is just to avoid them. Features of the language that are broken, don't use them. because it's just going to cause you pain. You might say, well, why don't I use it? Because it gives me this capability. Well, it turns out for basically every quirky thing in JavaScript, there's some other way to do it that isn't so annoying. And so you just do it that other way.
So comments, globals, so equality.
So one equals assignment. There is a double equal operator in JavaScript for equality. Don't use it. Just avoid it. The equality operator you want is three equals.
That's the compare we know.
This is for comparisons, to decide if two things are equal or not. The comparison operator you want, the equality comparison, use triple equals. Double equals? No. It is a valid operator in JavaScript. It does exist. It does test for equality, but not in the sense you generally want. For those of you who are familiar with like Lisp and stuff, this is equal, this is EQ, or EQV. It's one of those things, which is basically an equality operator you almost never want. What it comes down to is that it ends up doing a shallow comparison as opposed to a deep comparison of the data structures. Just use this. Again, quirks. Why in JavaScript normal code, why would you ever want to use a double? I don't know. And the other thing is numbers. JavaScript has no integers. They are just numbers. And the numbers are all floats. All doubles, specifically. There is no integer type. You might say, wait a second, how do you do counters? How do you do this? Well, you just use it normally and the environment takes care of it. But this does mean that you know all the issues with floating points when you do certain kinds of, you can't do integer division without using explicit truncates or other things. And you might say, well, doesn't that make things slow? Well, it can. It also means that if you're representing things where you care about exact decimals, it's tricky. Y'all know about issues with floating point notation, right?
It can only store 7 hacker decimals.
Well, this trouble with floating, that's it. It's what happens if you take a calculator and you say 1 divided by 3. What do you get? You get 0.33333. And then you multiply it times 3. What do you get? Depends on the calculator. But a lot of times, you'll just get 0.9999999. You won't get 1. And this is because it's an approximate representation. It's not giving you an exact representation of rational numbers. It's a decimal approximation. And so sometimes you will have errors. And so what if you multiply 0.9999 by 1,000 versus multiplying 1 by 1,000. Are those equal? No. And so if you do things like do these sort of multiplications and try using the equality operator, for operations that normally if you did it with precise operands, this will fail. So you have to always be conscious that you're using floats when you're doing numeric computations. And if you need to have exact representations, like maybe multiply all your numbers by 100 so everything, all the digits you care about are in the integer portion of the number as opposed to using the fractional part. There's an entire sub-discipline of computer science and mathematics known as numerical analysis, which tells you how to do things correctly with floating point numbers. I mean, people who do simulations or financial transactions, you normally just don't deal with floating points. You just deal with exact numbers. But if you're doing simulating the weather or nuclear explosions or something else like that, you have to use floating point numbers, and you have to keep track of how the errors propagate. Otherwise, you get very bad results.
Digression.
Oh, that's numbers. So the best way to understand symbols in a language like JavaScript is that a symbol can refer to any value. There are types in JavaScript, but types are associated with values. So symbols have no type. So one thing I was thinking of as an experiment was adding a break in my lectures of like 3 to 5 minutes in the middle. Because 80 minutes is a long time to hear anyone talk. So I'm going to take a short pause right now of, let's say, 3 minutes. Okay. Stop there. Okay, and we're back. Is that a good thing, taking a couple of minutes just to turn off? Okay. I will try to remember to do that.
It's good for me too. So
when you're looking at a JavaScript function and you look at a symbol, you don't know what value the symbol contains. It could be anything. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't any rules to the symbols. So, if I just see a value x, and I just see an assignment to it, you hope that that value is declared somewhere locally. So what we really now are talking about is scoping. And scoping is an important part of any language. But before I discuss scoping, let me discuss objects. So we'll put a var in front of this. So this is how in JavaScript you say, I want this variable to be local. My closest and closing scope is make it local. So let's say var x now I want this to be an object. The object notation in JavaScript is very simple. All it is curly braces, ended with a semicolon. If I do this here, this is an object. And inside of the object, you define the properties of the object. So, color, so I could be defining a computer, this could be part of a car or something. So I've got objects. This is an object, it's got certain attributes, and each of these have certain values. Here I'm using strings. What's the class of this object? There are no classes in JavaScript.
So is this like the equivalent of a structure in C?
Yes and no. Yes, in this, the syntax of structures in C basically looks like this. The difference is there are no types. So that has profound implications. Well, it's worse than that. It's not only there are no types. There's no restriction, except for the keyword. You know, there are certain
keywords, I think, there's a list of symbols that can't be properties or anything in an object. But except for that restriction, basically this can be anything. You can have any properties. There's no restriction on how many of them you have. There's basically no restriction on the names of them. There's no restriction on the types. It's just basically a key, a property, and a value. No classes. So that means, is there no inheritance?
Only if you define it within the object.
So there is inheritance. But the inheritance is a bit funny. It's not based on classes. So in a language like C++ or Java, you have a class hierarchy which says what the types are of all the objects and how they are related to each other. And so that if one object does not have a certain property to it, you look at its parent object. You look at the inheritance hierarchy of the classes in order to find out what is valid for a given object. In JavaScript, it's all valid. There's no such thing as assigning a property to an object and it not being allowed. It's all allowed. But that means, do I have to define everything for every time? No. What we instead have is prototypes. Specifically, it's prototype-based inheritance. And when you look at the structure of JavaScript, you should see that this is really the right way of doing things, given the other choices that were made in the language. Now, when I say there are no classes in JavaScript, that's not strictly true. There are certain little mechanisms that look kind of like classes and things like that, but basically ignore it because it's broken and doesn't do exactly what you expect. You do inheritance by prototype. And what that means is you can specify another object that will supply properties if a property is not instantiated inside of an object. Say prototype. Say car. So now I specify that there is this other object called car that will be the prototype 4x. So, in another language, I would have said this is of type car, or this inherits from car. This is maybe some specific, maybe it's an SUV type I want to put together. But here in JavaScript, none of that. So, functionally, what does specifying a prototype do? It's actually rather simple.
Adds it to the prototype chain?
Yeah, well, it adds it to the prototype chain. That's what the prototype chain is this. But what that means is it refers to how you do symbol resolution. So the way you refer to an object property, so like if I refer to model of x, I say x.model. Because any property is allowed in JavaScript, I can always just say x.foo equals 7. I can always do that. Make up some property and put it there and assign it a value. But now, if I say that, if I just want to know what's the value of x.foo, I want to say y equals x.foo. How do I find that out? What I do is I first look in the object and I see what properties it has. Is there a foo here? No.
But that, if I go through this, I say it's not there. I next check, well, does car have a property foo? And then if I go through all of car's properties and it doesn't have it, I look to see what its prototype is. Maybe car has a prototype of mechanized, mechanical thing or something, and then you look at its properties. You just go on up the chain. And only if you go all the way up the prototype chain and you don't find any property for any of that list of objects that has the property foo, will you say, oh, that doesn't exist. Will you generate an error?
And is car a file included in the file? Or is it something you define as a separate object in itself? I mean, is it like
strictly speaking, for this to be valid, somewhere before I have run code that defined car.
So there is
So remember, this read-eval print loop means there's this environment, and you keep stuffing things into the environment. And you could have done it by just typing it in there, or it could have been read from a file or whatever. But in the state of the system, in the environment, there is an object. Well, there is a... This isn't actually saying it's an object. It's just saying there is a symbol there. Mm-hmm. And for the prototype-based inheritance to work, this should probably be an object. But... really won't notice until you... Well, actually, everything's basically an object, except for primitive types. So you almost always can do this.
So I mean, like, in terms of being close to Java or whatnot, you know, in Java, you want to define the array list, you just include the array list. You import it, and then you define it.
Yeah, no, you don't do anything like... there are ways of doing importing and stuff like that. We'll talk about how you incorporate outside code when we talk about
noted modules. For prototyping, chances are we wrote that exact object somewhere.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. I mean, depending on when you start building node applications, you'll be incorporating lots of files with defined lots of objects. So you'll have lots of ways of doing things like this. Okay. Although normally you don't actually manually manipulate the prototype chain. There's other ways it's automatically set. But this is the mechanism of inheritance. Is just it doesn't. You read all the properties in an object. It's not there. These are the list of objects you also should look at.
You see? The order and matter, right now you have...
It's an unordered list. Unordered. It's a hash. It's an associative array. Really. It's key value store. You have property, value. Yes?
So I got
two
questions.
Uh-huh.
Is that a dot in between prototype and car?
Yes. Oh, no, that's not, that's a colon, sorry. Two dots. That's the basic object syntax.
So that changed my second
Yeah, no, sorry, that was two dots. So, yes?
So is color and model defined in car? Like, car has to have a color and model, or where does the color and model?
No, it doesn't. No, that's just properties I made up.
Just in text?
Just for X. There is no class. There are only objects. There are no types, except for types that are associated with the value of something. But it's just an object. An object, to a first approximation, objects in JavaScript are just like associative arrays in other languages. Use them. So you don't really use associative arrays that much in classic languages, in more static languages like C and Java. But if you use Python or something like that, they're all over the place. Or Perl. And you've all implemented things like associative arrays, right? In 2402? Hash tables? This is just implemented as a nice hash table. But that's... when you think of a fully dynamic language where you're going to be able to change things and you want to have as few restrictions on what you can type in as a valid statement, you can see it makes... having a class definition just restricts what's valid or not. It's really a method for... it's not for making things more expressive, it's for catching errors. And in really fully dynamic languages, they aren't interested in catching your errors when you type in the code. They want you to write whatever code you want, and if there are logical issues, those are detected at runtime. Assign whatever properties you want to an object. And in fact, you when you go this prototype chain always has some sort of value and it goes on up to the standard object. And so you actually have, in general, a lot more properties that can be accessed than you actually define. And so there are specific functions. Has property, I think, is the standard access of function. So you want to check to see, is this, when you say x dot foo, and you, if you just do an assignment, you know, x dot foo equals, you know, equals 7, as I said before, this always succeeds. But then later on, you're wondering, does x have a property foo? You have to specifically inquire. Because it might be that some of its prototypes has it.
Can a property be an object other than being a prototype?
Wait. Can a property be an object? No, these can all be objects. Remember, logical. I said that a symbol can refer to any value. More objects. So yes, objects can get nested inside of objects, can get nested inside of objects. And then this is how you build complex data structures in JavaScript. This is your pointer mechanism. But you see it's inherently safe. You can't really have a dangling pointer here.
Mm-hmm. The difference being if you're pointing to that, it will keep going down the chain until it finds something that it can...
So the idea of the prototype chain is just to say if I refer to some other thing like make, x dot make. Is there a make property defined here? No. But car may define a make value. Maybe it has a default make value of unknown.
And if car doesn't have it, does it go to
it goes to the prototype of car. It goes on up, and only if it goes all the way up to the top of the chain, there's nothing else, will it signal an error. But notice, if I assign a value here, if I do x dot make equals, if I do this assignment, x dot make equals question mark, where does this get stored? Let's assume that car has a property called make. And I do this assignment. Do I change this for X or do I change it for car? Who says car? Who says X? It's X.
What does it change in X?
You change the. If I did this assignment here, by x dot make equals this, this would create here a thing called make, and that would have a property question mark. That's what running this statement would do. Would be logically to change this here. Assignments never change prototypes. Prototype chain is read only. You never write to a prototype. If you want to write to the prototype, you have to manually specify that object. Like if I wanted to modify car, I could say x.prototype.make equals question mark. If I instead said x.prototype.make equals Tesla, then, because all cars in the future are going to be made by Tesla, after all. So, this would make car get a new property called Tesla. but only because I followed it down the prototype chain. If I just say x.make, then it's going to go here.
So it's my understanding that the variable x can have all the properties that the prototype has, but it can't write unless you follow the chain.
I think it's the opposite. So just repeat what you said.
X can have all the properties that car is defined, but it can only write to what car has, but car's properties.
It can only write to what X has.
X can.
When you write to X, you're just writing to X. You never write to a prototype.
But in that last sentence,
the last sentence, I did write to its prototype, but that's because I followed it. I said X dot prototype, because X dot prototype, this is car. Right? This is equivalent to just writing car. Think of this as pointer manipulation. Safe pointer manipulation. That's all these are. Symbols in JavaScript are fundamentally all pointers. Just type safe. Well, safe ones.
So if you have more than one prototype in X,
you cannot have more than one prototype. There's just a prototype reference. It's a chain.
So that's going to bring error if you type.
If I could reassign the prototype. I could say x.prototype equals some other object. Okay. And I've just changed the prototype chain. It's just replaced it. You can only have one property with a given name for an object. And so, but this is that if, notice here I said, so if I run this statement, x.make equals this, and x.prototype.make equals Tesla, if I just now type x.make, what's the value of it? It's question mark. It's question mark because it first searches this for properties before going up the prototype chain. So anything that's specified here is referenced first before doing it. So these shadow it. So that's the basic mechanism. When you do an assignment, you can overwrite, in a sense, what's in the prototype, but you're not overwriting it. You're just shadowing it. You're making it so you can't access it. Another object that had the same prototype that didn't specify that property would still have that value. The prototype has not been changed. Yes.
So is prototype just a generic name for the object?
Prototype is a special property of an object.
So is that a data type?
What? It's a what?
Is it like a data type? Or
no. It's a mechanism. Think of this very simplistically, that you've got the runtime system of JavaScript. It's sitting there. It has a question. It says, okay, I have this symbol X. Okay, the symbol X, it refers to an object. Okay, now I have this object. I need to check out what the object that X refers to. It has some number of properties. I need to access the foo property. So I look in the object. I see, does it have I want to get the value of the foo property of X. I look in this object. Is there a foo property? Yes or no? If there is yes, done. Return that value. If it's no, if you didn't have this mechanism, you'd just say error. Because the object doesn't have that. By having the prototype, we now say, oh, it's not specified for this one, but maybe one of its prototypes specifies a value. Basically, the prototypes specify defaults. Not through the prototype chain. But you can, if you see how flexible this is, you can get things like multiple inheritance because you can mix together objects very simply.
Can you have multiple, I don't know if we can call them objects, but something like X have its prototype be the same thing? Like your X and your Y both have the prototype car.
Yes. And thus, car is acting like a class in another language, but it's just a prototype. It's, and in particular, notice, I can dynamically change the definition of car at runtime. And anything that uses it as a prototype, its behavior changes. I can add new properties to it. I could change them or something. I can make the default, you know, make of it not be Tesla. I can make it Ford. And every other object that uses a prototype will instantly change. But anyone that manually specified a make will not be effective. So it's a very simple but a bit confusing when you look in the context of the other things you've learned. Because you're like, wait, isn't it doing this and this? No, it's not doing that. There's very little mechanism. If you think about how complex it is for Java and like where the type resolution here and here and the syntax and stuff like that, no, there's none of that here. Now, the cost of not having all that other mechanism, it means that the runtime doesn't check you, doesn't catch simple errors the way that Java will. But the philosophy of a language like JavaScript is that the simple errors aren't what get you into trouble. It's the complex ones. And the complex errors... type checking does not help with complex errors, and in fact, it makes it harder to write code. It makes code more verbose, and makes it less flexible. Makes it more brittle. So we'll take some number of little annoying simple errors for this greater flexibility.
So is a car a variable structure like the X?
Car, this is not a, this is object notation.
Okay,
so if I go over here and say, what does car look like? If I were to, so remember this whole read eval print loop? I can tell JavaScript to output the value of car. And the syntax it will use will be this. And then you could always input it in and then get back the same data structure. So if I wanted to ask the interpreter, what is the value of car? I should be able to say car, and it should output something like car equals, it's an object, and then it will give some number of properties. And the properties we referred to so far is make, which right now we're like Tesla, and some other ones. Okay, we're just about out of time here. So the thing I will end with is if these are objects, what about methods? Right? What's object-oriented programming if you don't have methods for objects? Where do you put the methods? Is there another mechanism for doing methods?
As a function inside the object.
All a method is in JavaScript is a property of, let's say, crash. It's just a function. That's a method. You can just define functions in line. This is an anonymous function that's getting this name, just like I defined a function elsewhere. Methods are just another symbol that's a property of an object that just happens to have a function as its value instead of a number or another object or something. It has a function. These functions are, of course, objects, but they, of course, also functions. So this concept is known as functions are being our first class. It means functions are a data type just like anything else. They can be treated like any other data. They can be generated on the fly. They can be passed around. You can kind of do this in Java, but it ain't pretty. JavaScript is basic. It's part of its fundamentals, just like it's the basis of schema. And that's where the real power comes in. And I'll end there.